everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA as well as their fabulous Summer Yearly Writers Conference at pnwa.org. You know, I love what I think of as publication stories, stories of how a writer and their book find their way to the bookshelves. And two of my favorite stories are the story of how Richard Bach sold Jonathan Livingston Seagull and how Garth Stein sold The Art of Racing in the Rain. And though every publication story is different, these two stories are strangely similar. Both are narrated, are inspirational stories, narrated by animals. Jonathan Livingston Seagull, of course, narrated by a seagull, and The Art of Racing in the Rain is narrated by a dog. And both of these stories, both these books, met with quite a bit of resistance when they were first presented to the publishing world. Richard had a terrible time finding a publisher, and Garth couldn't even find an agent for The Art of Racing in the Rain. But both of these books went on to have tremendous success and really establish both writers' careers and what they are now. Richard Bach's The Jonathan Livingston Seagull sold 44 million copies and counting, probably. And The Art of Racing in the Rain spent over 156 weeks on the bestseller list. That's 3 years if you don't have a calculator. So why the similarity? What do we attribute this? Well, we don't have to figure it out ourselves. We can ask Garth, because he's here with me right now. Garth, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Well, it's great. Now, what do you think about that, Garth? I can't stop thinking about the similarities between your two books. I know, obviously, it wasn't on your mind when you wrote it, but it is a strange... There is a similar trajectory they followed in their resistance and their eventual breaking out.
I know, and I totally wouldn't take my little pencil charcoal sketches of dogs that I had that I wanted to intersperse. No. I there's the question of... allegory and fable and what an adult audience will read and what they won't. And so I think that was kind of the similarity that that Jonathan Livingston Seagull had and Enzo the dog had. You know, adults are supposed to be proper and only read about sex and neckties and handcuffs. So,
well, although, you know, I was talking to literary agent Donald Moss last summer. We brought up your book, as a matter of fact, and we both agreed that The Art of Racing in the Rain, obviously it's hard to categorize, but it's generally in literary fiction, you know, this sort of broad tent. And the one thing it has that sometimes literary writers are unwilling to step close to is a sort of spiritual point of view, because it's dealing with death, and it's dealing with the idea of the continuation of life after death and of something sort of bigger than us. And,
yeah,
and Livingston Seagull does that as well.
Yeah, I think that there is a certain, if you were to talk to my darling wife, she would explain to you that back in the 60s when they were all singing about the dawning of the age of Aquarius, they were off by a little bit. That we're really in the dawning of the age of Aquarius now, and that the spiritual awakening, you know, is a longer process than just, an acid trip. So I think that there's a people like that right now. It's in the ether, the idea of spirituality on sort of a more universal level and not religion specific. Honestly, I like to say it's all about recycling, you know. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, they had to have, the Don't Be a Litter Bug, Pick It Up campaign because people, recycling was throwing your Rainier beer can into the median of the highway. And now we've got like five different containers and 17, you know, it's this massive campaign. And the bottom line is, what happened? Well, we thought someone else was supposed to be doing the recycling. The government was supposed to take care of it. And in fact, that's not the case. It's about personal accountability. And the individual has to take care of it. And I think that message really resonates now. And that sort of, that's kind of what's behind the art of racing in the rain, if you will.
I think you're absolutely right. I do think that I think your darling wife is actually right about the dawning of the age of Aquarius. I do think there's a shift happening now that was sort of begun then, but was really in its infancy and is starting to grow up now.
Yeah.
We're seeing it all around.
I think, and, you know, I call her my darling wife with a little, you know, a little tongue-in-cheek there, because she just left my office with her bloody scalpel, because she was going over the first draft of my new book and telling me the ways that it should be improved. And she had
so
a little
you
bit
show
of
it
evil.
To her. She gets
oh, yeah, she had a little bit of
evil
smile
freedom.
On her face as she I was putting my intestines back into my abdomen. Yeah, she's my first reader always, and she's very good with certain elements, especially plot and story, you know, tracking storylines and stuff like that. So I always like to have her kind of say, "Oh, okay, we're drifting here. Okay, now get back on track." So it's very helpful.
Now, what is your strong suit? Is plot, for instance? I know a lot of writers where they struggle there, but they are great at maintaining the tone and having the feeling they want, but they have to rally to find a story. Like, in fact, interesting, Chris Cleave, his book, it was on the bestseller list at the same time. What am I thinking of?
Little B.
Right, Little B. He said the same thing. He loves character, but he loves their evolution, but he has a hard time finding plot for them sometimes. Are you that way?
My training, I went to film school. I have an MFA in film, and I studied screenwriting. So I have a little more sort of measured approach in terms of trying to be plot clear before I get started. But I do get distracted, and in the midst of writing, and that's why I need to have someone who I can trust to call me out on it, you know?
When you say distracted, you don't mean you're staring out the window and looking at the birds. You mean your story is wandering places that maybe it shouldn't.
Yeah, or you know, maybe something isn't as heightened. Maybe it, to me, because I have it in my notes and I have it in my head and I know these characters, I say, well, it's obvious to me that this is why this is happening, the cause and effect of this. And that's really what plot is all about, the cause and effect and the intentions. And so the cause and effect are, I know they're there, and I'm pretty sure. But then in the course of dialogue and in the course of the narrative, maybe it isn't evident to a third party. And that's why I think every writer has to have someone very dependable and very close to him or her to be, and doesn't necessarily have to be a spouse, but that's just the way it works out with me.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, you have what's up in your head, and you know so much.
Right.
You don't want to give too much because then you'll bore them. But if you give too little, they can't follow it.
Exactly. And then and then it becomes diluted and kind of watery. And then people are like, well, he's just wandering around. Why is he wandering around? I'm like, no, he's not wandering around. I guess I said that he's wandering around, but I didn't mean that he's wandering around. But I meant, and so
you know, if we made a movie about the selling of The Art of Racing in the Rain, if we made a short documentary about that, it would be a very good film, I think. And I think my favorite moment in that film would be, and by the way, to my listeners, you can listen to or watch Garth tell this story, maybe many places, but on Author, it's part of the interview I did with him a few years ago. So if you want to hear the whole story, but perhaps one of my favorite parts, and I think in many ways, when I've heard you tell it, maybe your favorite part too, is that moment. Couple days before Thanksgiving, I believe you were standing outside Whole Foods, if I got the details correctly.
Yes, it was Whole Foods.
And you had to fire your agent.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
that's a huge moment.
You know what? Let me tell you something. The guy, what was his name? Baumgartner, Bill Baumgartner, whatever his name is, the guy who jumped out of the balloon from
27.
Yeah. Okay. So when he's down on the ground interviewing him afterwards, he's like, oh, yeah, man. There was this really cool part where I threw myself out of and went 800 miles an hour from 27 miles in the air.
Right.
Okay. That's not what he was thinking when he was jumping. Okay. So it's fun to tell the story, but in retrospect, it would be nice if no one ever had to get to that point of having to do that particular gut check.
No, you weren't enjoying that moment.
No, I did not enjoy it. I enjoyed it in retrospect. It's a fun story to tell. Yeah.
No, but the reason I always think it's significant when you tell it is, for you in the narrative of your life, that has to be, obviously, that's a critical turning point moment. Because if you had said, because to paraphrase for our listeners, Garth had written this book, The Art of Racing in the Rain, had a draft of it, and you loved it, right? I mean, you felt you had nailed it. And you showed it to your agent. And for the record, your first two books had sold okay, but the second one hadn't sold very much. The first one sold okay, but not great. So it wasn't like your career at this point was burning up the charts.
No, definitely not. Yes.
So you were still trying to get it going. And
yeah.
your agent, you sent it to your agent, and was it a he? I can't remember. I think it was a
It was a he, but he shall remain nameless. But
he said, forget it. I can't sell it. It won't sell.
Yeah.
It's told by a dog.
The quote is, throw this book away and write me something I can sell.
Wow.
Which has kind of riled me up. But, you know, I had some practice with this because my second book, I kind of did the same thing. When I wrote my second book, How Evan Broke His Head and Other Secrets, I gave it to my then agent, who was my first agent, so it was a different person, and she read it and said, oh, let's work on it a little. We worked on it a little bit, and then she's like, I'll send it out. So she sent it out, and it got passed on by everybody she sent it to. And I said, I think I know the problem. Let me take it back and do a rewrite. And so I did, and it took a lot longer than I thought. So 2 years later, I sent it back to her, and she said, I don't have the energy for this. And so she released me to seek alternative representation.
Uh-huh.
Right, which means I was fired by my agent.
Right.
And it's really hard to get a new agent,
Yes.
So I ended up having to say, am I going to put this book aside and write something else, or do I really believe in it? And I did believe in it, and so I ended up selling it myself to Soho Press.
Oh, you did yourself. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I went and got an agent to say, you run the deal.
Right.
It's like... agents are happy to take their 15% if they don't have to do any work.
Oh, but see, but still different. It's still different. You know, there's something about, because everybody has those moments where they stand there and they say, do I do the thing which feels right but which seems dangerous, or do I do the conceivably safer thing, which you've got this agent, and they're the professional, and they're the ones that blah, blah, blah. You could put this book down and follow their advice, and you followed your own at that moment, and it certainly worked out for you.
Well, I think that, when I talk to high school students and stuff, whenever I go out and do community reads and stuff, I always try and book a high school to go in and talk to kids if they want to have me, because I like to tell them this story and say that in your life you're going to face obstacles, you're going to face two roads diverging in a yellow wood, and you're going to have to pick which road. And there's only one person. Everyone can tell you which road to pick, but they don't have to travel it. You have to. So you better pick the road that resonates in your heart, because you have to live with the consequences. No one else does. Everyone else can say, oh, well, I guess you picked wrong. Whoops.
Yeah.
But you're stuck. So you really have to, I believe, go with your heart and go with your gut and say, are you willing to stand behind this or not? And quite frankly, if you're not, don't take the risk. It's okay. Not everything is you don't have to always take the tough road. Sometimes it is right to put down a book and say and walk away from it. But if you really believe it, then you owe it to yourself to not be distracted by people who are throwing pennies at you. That's what Tiger Woods is. Father used to do, apparently. I heard that.
Oh,
story.
Really? Through pennies?
Yeah, when he was five, he'd be on the putting green, and his father would be throwing pennies at him, saying, don't get distracted, keep putting.
Well, I guess it worked. Thanks, Dad.
Yeah.
Well, but here's the thing, is I think when you're confronted with those choices, and if the choice is one, if this choice that really resonates with you, and if there's a choice that really resonates with you, not taking it in the end would be harder. It might be, it might feel easier at that moment because you don't, you, there's less resistance from the world around you, maybe your loved ones or your family or whatever. But in the end, that choice would weigh on you and would pull on you, I think.
Yeah.
Overall.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And I think you know it. I mean, if I don't know if you did you read that the Stephen King on writing book?
No, I did not.
Oh, it
good one I heard though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fun book to read, but his is absolutely worthless in terms of, like, if you're wanting to get writing tips or something, because he's basically like, okay, what you do is you get a great idea, you sit down, and you write it, and then you sell it. But he had this one thing that he says. He says, you know, he was, I think he was talking about Carrie, and he said, you know, sometimes it's like a baseball thing. You know, you get up to the home base, you get up to bat there, and sometimes you hit it, and you, like, say to yourself, oh, that was a single. And you hit it, and you say to yourself, that was a double. And sometimes you hit it, and you just say, wow, I really got a hold of that one. And he felt that way after he's written a couple of his books. And I think that you know, I felt that way. That's why I was, that's why I fired my agent. I thought, I think I got a hold of this one.
Yeah.
And if you know it like that, if you could feel that, then you got a hold of it. Then go find your right venue. You just haven't knocked on enough doors yet, you know?
You know, and one of the things about writing I think that it teaches us is, you know, you face that blank page every day. And in the end, you have to commit to choice after choice after choice after choice. And you're all alone with it. And this, and in the end, your name's going to have to be on that. You know, your wife's your reader, and she goes through it, and she's going to cut it up, and why'd you do this, and blah, blah, and that's great, and you'll go through it, and it's helpful. But in the end, it's going to be Garth Stein on the bottom of that book.
That's right.
And so you've got to be able to stand behind every one of the choices you make. And
absolutely.
There's no one else who can tell you, you know, the editors. And don't you find also with people who are reading it, you really are the one who knows what it's supposed to be. Their comments can guide you, but they can't.
Yes.
They might suggest things. They could be all wrong, but you know what it's supposed to be.
Right. I like to say that a reader, as good as a reader is, can't tell you how to fix it. A reader can only tell you what's wrong with it, where the soft spot is. And they can tell you that, and that's very helpful. But the idea of, and then what you should do is blah, 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 that's not helpful at all.
No.
Because they're pointing to a problem. They're pointing to a problem on page 250, and they're saying, ooh, see here, this moment, oh, I don't believe this character, and I don't believe this situation would happen like this, and et cetera, et cetera. What you should do is fix it by doing this, this, this. No, no, no. What you should do is fix it by finding out where you went wrong. Because you went wrong somewhere back on page 30 or page 62.
Right.
You had a character act in a way that gave the reader an impression of the character's intention and motivation.
Right.
And that made the an event that occurs much later not work. So you don't have to change that event. You have to go back and change where you made the character go wrong on page 32.
Right.
So you have to find – now, sometimes you do have to change the event, right? But part of the problem is that character – part of the problem with writers, especially working on their first book, is you're so busy trying to make characters do and make your story do what you want them to do. And what I always try and tell writers is the first – you get to do that once. In your first draft, you get to – that's all about you, baby. It's your ideas. It's what you want. It's what you're trying to say. Every subsequent draft after the first draft, you are writing for your characters and for your book, and you owe them. And it's not about you anymore. It is about those characters and that book and making them be true to their nature so that they can reach out and touch a reader.
Yeah, it's really true. You have to give over to what you actually have put down there.
That's right. That's
There's
right.
Something
then, yeah, because otherwise it becomes contrived.
Yeah.
And a reader picks up on that in a second. And, you know, those books that you get two-thirds of the way through and you say, it was good, but I don't buy this. And you put it down.
Yep.
Ooh.
I know. You know, which reminds me, I was at a gathering of writers the other night, and we got to talking about a subject which is not my favorite subject, but which writers seem to want to talk about these days ad nauseum, and that is marketing. Marketing, marketing, marketing. Now, I still believe that the best piece of marketing is a really great book.
Yes.
I think that's your, that should be where 95% of your effort goes. But a lot of writers want to say, well, yeah, but then I got to market it. Now, Art of Racing the Rain came out before there was this mad crush that the author should be on a constant blog tour and so on. And it did okay. But it wasn't, that wasn't because they took out ads in the New York Times or anything, was it?
The Art of Racing in the Rain?
Yeah. How did that take off? Did it do a lot of word of mouth? Did it get great reviews?
It was almost all word of mouth. I did have the benefit of, I got to be honest with you, of it was the last book that Starbucks picked and sold as a Starbucks book.
All right.
So we got a nice launch out of that, which was, of course, very helpful. But I will say
they had to pick it.
They had to pick it, yeah. I am very proud of one thing. This book somehow was kind of marginalized by literary critics.
I have that doesn't surprise me at all. I'm not saying because of the writing, but given its nature, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, I like to say 97% of the people in the world are willing to suspend their disbelief and take a dog as a narrator, and the other 3% are book reviewers.
I agree. There's a certain mindset, but okay. So it didn't get the New York Times front page review.
Didn't get anything in the New York Times. For a while, there was a time where Racing in the Rain was on the bestseller list of the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Herald, the Miami Tribune. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
The Chicago Tribune or whatever the Chicago paper is, San Francisco, L.A., Seattle, and there must have been one more. Did I say Boston yet? Boston
Maybe
Globe?
Yeah.
It was on 10 bestseller lists, and not one of those newspapers reviewed the book.
Oh.
That's word of mouth.
Holy moly.
So, yeah.
Well, that was before there was much online reviews at all, probably.
Yeah. Well, it was getting around. But the independent bookstores have always been big supporters of mine, and I've been big supporters of them. And I did like 180 events in the first, for the hardcover and the paper, but in the first, 18 months of the publication, if you consider hardcover and the transition to paperback.
Wow.
So I was on the road a lot, and I went out and flogged the thing, and that does it. People want that sort of thing, but you have to, you have to devote yourself. Not everybody wants to, and not everybody does, and some people are very successful, doing it a different way, and that's fine. I think it depends on your personality.
All right, so now you're working on the next one.
Yeah.
And I know you don't even really have a working title for it yet, and you've finished the first draft. And I know this first draft was a bear. I've talked to you at various times along the way, and you've been trying to figure out, do I tell it sequentially? Am I going to bop around time?
Yeah.
It sounds like it's kind of a big story, whereas the Art of Racing the Rain is a pretty tight story in terms of it's a very, I don't know what it started out as, but it's a very compact idea in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty, hero seeks chalice, overcomes obstacles, hero achieves goal.
Right.
This book that I'm working on now is much longer, deals with a five generations of a family history.
And has ghosts involved in it, does it not?
And there are ghosts in it. It's got a very spiritual element to it as well. And, I spent a long time, it turns out, I spent almost 3 years writing backstory.
It will not be used.
Which I didn't think was backstory.
Oh, God.
I thought it was my book.
Oh, God, Garth. Okay. Oh, so oh man. All right.
I hate writing so much. I wrote this book, and I thought I liked it, and no one else did, and finally there was that moment,
yeah.
Where am I? I mean, am I pushing this or not? And I realized everything I had written, I had done for a reason because I needed to know that story.
Yeah.
But in fact, I have to tell the story from an entirely different perspective, an entirely different point of view, entirely different tone. And that's my story that incorporates all the backstory. And I'm using parts of it, but that 100-some thousand words that I wrote is not really usable. And so that happened in August. And so then between August and now, I've written the new iteration, and I'm very happy with it. I love the narrator. I love the voice. I have all this great background I can just pull from and dip into.
Right.
But, you know,
whoa,
sometimes it can be frustrating to be working that long and say, yeah, what are you going to do about it?
Wow. I tell you, that is where it takes such – all right, so what's your advice to someone? Because this is a part of writing sometime. I've had that type of experience. And it's a tough pill to swallow in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think in particular keeping a sense of freshness and enthusiasm for the work, because you have to, you know, you don't want to just try and finish the damn thing because you're sick
right.
of it. You know,
right.
it's still got to be interesting to you.
Well, yeah.
How do you do it, Garth? How do you keep your interest after all that?
I think that there's a certain amount of, first of all, it's always fun to be in the zone and have that writing just go bam, 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 just like
yeah.
writing like crazy. That's great. We love that. But that doesn't always happen. And sometimes we just got to go out and dig the ditches and chop the wood and put in our work and be disciplined.
Yeah. It,
because through that discipline comes epiphany sometimes, right?
Yeah.
There is a point of diminishing returns where the project just isn't working and you're still flogging away at it and it's not going to come together. And that is a point where every writer has to say, why am I doing this? Am I doing this because I want to write a story that will be transformative and readers will love, or am I doing it because my ego is big enough that I think I can wrestle this story to the ground?
Yeah.
And I think that's a very critical moment. And what I would, any advice I would like to say, what I've tried to live with in the past is, even if you have to put something aside, it was not in vain. Your writing of it helped you develop as a writer. You were practicing your tools. You're working on your characters. You're working on your dialogue. You're working on your plotting. You're working on story. So it was not a waste. Don't let the feeling that, oh, my gosh, I've just wasted 2 years of my life, don't let that get to you, because it isn't a waste. It's good. It's healthy. Now, go find a story that you can be in love with and write that story.
Yeah. I really agree. I think that's great advice, Garth, because all writing, I really feel like, in some way, I write every day, and I write 5 days a week, and I feel like every day, in some small way, I've gotten better. I can't always point to it, but I always feel like something has been learned, whether that thing will go on to be published or not. I feel like something has changed for me.
Yeah.
I don't know if I had that experience or not.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, and it's great. It's as long as we can see, we have to love, as writers, we have to love the process. We
you better, boy.
We can't do it just because we want to have that shiny, you know, hardcover book on the wall. We have to love what we're doing. And if we don't, the story or the book is going to come off with that kind of bitter edge of, why are you forcing me to write this book for you? Why don't you just give me my Pulitzer Prize?
Yeah.
That's kind of a down note. So
but it's true. Is that if you think you're doing it for some reason other than to, I mean, the money is great. I mean, success and adulation and all that is great. And you've had that experience with The Art of Racing the Rain. It's had a lot of success. You've met a lot of people, I think, to whom the book has meant a tremendous amount. But that feeling of something within you reaching other people and it meaning something to them, I can't replace it. You know, I get it even on a small amount, and I love it.
Oh, a book, no matter how many people read your book, a book is read one person at a time. And even if it's listened to by four people in a car on an audiobook, it's still being interpreted one individually, because every reader reads a book through the lens of his or her own experiences and ideas and values. And so everybody plugs into it on a different level. And so it's a very personal – reading a book is a very personal experience. And that's I think, how we have to respect it. And as writers, we have to respect our readers. You know, it takes a lot of energy. I'm asking you to sit down and take your time and your attention to read my book.
Right.
It better
be
good. It better be good.
That is such a perfect note to end our discussion. Garth, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Bill.
My pleasure indeed. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. I'm going to be off next week while I'm down in San Francisco, but I'll be back the week after that with the poet Edward Hirsch. Until then, write what you love. Do what you love. You can't go wrong. Thanks for listening.